Brown Ben scratched at his beard. "Could deliver you alive and wriggling in, or pop your head into a jar and pickle it, or throw in with me. That's the wisest move." He grinned. "I was born a second son. This company is my destiny."
"The second sons have no place for mamas," the bravo in pink said scornfully. "It's fighters we need."
"I brought you one." Tyrion jerked a thumb at Mormont.
"That creature," the bravo laughed. "An ugly brute, but scars alone don't make a second son."
Tyrion rolled his mismatched eyes. "Lord Plum, who are these two friends of yours? The pink one is annoying." The bravo curled a lip, whilst the fellow with a quill chuckled at his insolence. But it was Jorah Mormont who supplied their names. "Inkpots is the company paymaster. The peacock calls himself Casporio, the cunning. Though Casporio, the cunt, would be more apt. Nasty piece of work." Mormont's face might have been unrecognizable in its battered state, but his voice was unchanged. Casporio gave him a startled look, whilst the wrinkles around Plum's eyes crinkled in amusement.
"Jorah Mormont, is that you? Less proud than when you scampered off, though. Must we call you Sir?"
Sir Jorah's swollen lips twisted into a grotesque grin.
"Give me a sword, and you can call me what you like, Ben."
Casporio edged backward.
"You... she sent you away."
"I came back. Call me a fool." "A fool in love." Tyrion cleared his throat. "You can talk of old times later, after I've done explaining why my head would be of more use to you upon my shoulders. You will find, Lord Plum, that I can be very generous to my friends. If you doubt me, ask Bronn, ask Shagga, son of Dolph, ask Timmit, son of Timmit."
"And who would they be?" asked the man called Inkpots.
"Good men who pledged me their swords and prospered greatly by that service." He shrugged. "Oh, very well. I lied about the good part. They're bloodthirsty bastards like you lot."
"Might be," said Brown Ben. "Or might be you just made up some names. Shagga, did you say? Is that a woman's name?"
"His teats are big enough. Next time we meet, I'll peek beneath his breeches to be sure. Oh, is that a saver set over there? Bring it out, and we'll have that game. But first, I think, a cup of wine. My throat is dry as an old bone, and I can see that I have a deal of talking to do."
Davos. Blackwater Bay was rough and choppy, white caps everywhere. Black Betha rode the flood tide, her sail cracking and snapping at each shift of wind. Wraith and Lady Maria sailed beside her, no more than 20 yards between their hulls. His sons could keep a line. Davos took pride in that. Across the sea, war horns boomed, deep, throaty moans like the calls of monstrous serpents, repeated ship to ship. "Bring down the sail," Davos commanded. "Lower mast! Oarsmen, to your oars!" His son Mathis relayed the commands. The deck of Black Betha churned as crewmen ran to their tasks, pushing through the soldiers, who always seemed to be in the way, no matter where they stood. Sir Imrie had decreed that they would enter the river on oars alone, so as not to expose their sails to the scorpions and spitfires on the walls of King's Landing. Davos could make out Fury well to the southeast, her sails shimmering golden as they came down. The crown stag of Baratheon blazoned on the canvas. From her decks, Stannis Baratheon had commanded the assault on Dragonstone 16 years before, but this time he had chosen to ride with his army, trusting Fury and the command of his fleet to his wife's brother, Sir Imrie, who'd come over to his cause at Storm's End with Lord Alistair and all the other Florence. Davos knew Fury as well as he knew his own ships. Above her 300 oars was a deck given over wholly to scorpions, and topside she mounted catapults fore and aft, large enough to fling barrels of burning pitch. A most formidable ship, and very swift as well, although Sir Imre had packed her bow to stern with armoured knights and men-at-arms, at some cost to her speed. The war horns sounded again, commands drifting back from the Fury. Davos felt a tingle in his missing fingertips.
"Out oars!" he shouted. "Form line!"
100 blades dipped down into the water as the oarmaster's drum began to boom. The sound was like the beating of a great slow heart, and the oars moved at every stroke, 100 men pulling as one. Wooden wings had sprouted from the Wraith, and Lady Maria as well. The three galleys kept pace, their blades churning the water.
"Slow cruise!" Davos called.
Lord Valerian's silver-hulled Pride of Driftmark had moved into her position to port of Wraith, and Bold Laughter was coming up fast. But Harridan was only now getting her oars into the water, and Seahorse was still struggling to bring down her mast. Davos looked astern. Yes, there, far to the south, that could only be Swordfish, lagging as ever. She dipped 200 oars and mounted the largest ram in the fleet, though Davos had grave doubts about her captain. He could hear soldiers shouting encouragement to each other across the water. They'd been little more than ballast since storm's end, and were eager to get at the foe, confident of victory. In that they were of one mind with their admiral, Lord High Captain Sir Emery Florent. 3 days passed, he had summoned all his captains to a war council aboard the Fury, while the fleet lay anchored at the mouth of the Wendwater in order to acquaint them with his dispositions. Davos and his sons had been assigned a place in the second line of battle, well out on the dangerous starboard wing.
"A place of honour,"
Allard had declared, well satisfied with the chance to prove his valour.
"A place of peril," his father had pointed out.
His sons had given him pitying looks, even young Merrick.
"The Onion Knight has become an old woman," he could hear them thinking. "Still a smuggler at heart."
Well, the last was true enough. He would make no apologies for it. Seaworth had a lordly ring to it, but down deep he was still Davos of Flea Bottom, coming home to his city on its three high hills. He knew as much of ships and sails and shores as any man in the Seven Kingdoms, and had fought his share of desperate fights, sword to sword, on a wet deck. But to this sort of battle he came a maiden, nervous and afraid. Smugglers do not sound war horns and raise banners. When they smell danger, they raise sail and run before the wind. Had he been admiral, he might have done it all differently. For a start, he would have sent a few of his swiftest ships to probe upriver and see what awaited them, instead of smashing in headlong. When he had suggested as much to Sir Emery, the Lord High Captain had thanked him courteously, but his eyes were not as polite. "Who is this low-born craven?" those eyes asked. "Is he the one who bought his knighthood with an onion?" With four times as many ships as the boy king, Sir Imre saw no need for caution or deceptive tactics. He had organized the fleet into 10 lines of battle, each of 20 ships. The first two lines would sweep up the river to engage and destroy Joffrey's little fleet, or the boy's toys, as Sir Imre dubbed them to the mirth of his lordly captains. Those that followed would land companies of archers and spearmen beneath the city walls, and only then join the fight on the river. The smaller, slower ships to the rear would ferry over the main part of Stannis's host from the south bank, protected by Salador Saan and his Lyseni, who would stand out in the bay in case the Lannisters had other ships hidden up along the coast, poised to sweep down on their rear. To be fair, there was reason for Sir Imre's haste. The winds had not used them kindly on the voyage up from Storm's End. They had lost two cogs to the rocks of Shipbreaker Bay on the very day they set sail, a poor way to begin. One of the Mearish galleys had foundered in the Straits of Tarth, and a storm had overtaken them as they entered the gullet, scattering the fleet across half the narrow sea. All but 12 ships had finally regrouped behind the sheltering spine of Massey's Hook in the calmer waters of Blackwater Bay, but not before they had lost considerable time. Stannis would have reached the rush days ago. The King's Road ran from Storm's End straight to King's Landing, a much shorter route than by sea, and his host was largely mounted, near 20,000 knights, light horse, and free riders, Renly's unwilling legacy to his brother. They would have made good time, but armored destriers and 12-foot lances would avail them little against the deep waters of Blackwater Rush and the high stone walls of the city. Stannis would be camped with his lords on the south bank of the river, doubtless seething with impatience and wondering what Sir Imry had done with his fleet. Off Merlin Rock, 2 days before, they had sighted a half-dozen fishing skiffs. The fisherfolk had fled before them, but one by one they had been overtaken and boarded. "A small spoon of victory is just the thing to settle the stomach before battle," Sir Imry had declared happily. "It makes the men hungry for a larger helping." But Davos had been more interested in what the captives had to say about the defences of King's Landing. The dwarf had been busy building some sort of boom to close off the mouth of the river, though the fishermen differed as to whether the work had been completed or not. He found himself wishing it had. If the river was closed to them, Sir Imry would have no choice but to pause and take stock. The sea was full of sounds, shouts and calls, war horns and drums and the trill of pipes, the slap of wood on water as thousands of oars rose and fell. "Keep line!" Davos shouted. A gust of wind tugged at his old green cloak. A jerkin of boiled leather and a pot helm at his feet were his only armour. At sea, heavy steel was as like to cost a man his life as to save it, he believed. Sir Imry and the other high-born captains did not share his view. They glittered as they paced their decks. Harridan and Seahorse had slipped into their places now, and Lord Celtigar's Red Claw beyond them. To starboard of Allard's Lady Maria were the three galleys that Stannis had seized from the unfortunate Lord Sunglass, Piety, Prayer, and Devotion, their decks crawling with archers. Even Swordfish was closing, lumbering, and rolling through a thickening sea under both oars and sail. "A ship that has that many oars ought to be much faster," Davos reflected with disapproval. "It's that ram she carries. It's too big. She has no balance." The wind was gusting from the south, but under oars it made no matter. They would be sweeping in on the flood tide, but the Lannisters would have the river current to their favour, and the Blackwater Rush flowed strong and swift where it met the sea. The first shock would inevitably favour the foe. "We are fools to meet them on the Blackwater," Davos thought. In any encounter on the open sea, their battle lines would envelop the enemy fleet on both flanks, driving them inward to destruction. On the river, though, the numbers and weight of Sir Emery's ships would count for less. They could not dress more than 20 ships abreast, lest they risk tangling their oars and colliding with each other. Beyond the line of warships, Davos could see the Red Keep up on Aegon's High Hill, dark against a lemon sky, with the mouth of the rush opening out below. Across the river, the south shore was black with men and horses, stirring like angry ants as they caught sight of the approaching ships. Stannis would have kept them busy building rafts and fletching arrows. Yet even so, the waiting would have been a hard thing to bear. Trumpets sounded among them, tiny and brazen, soon swallowed by the roar of 1,000 shouts. Davos closed his stubby hand around the pouch that held his finger bones and mouthed a silent prayer for luck. Fury herself would centre the first line of battle, flanked by the Lord Stephen and the Stag of the Sea. each of 200 oars. On the port and starboard wings were the hundreds. Lady Hera, Brightfish, Laughing Lord, Sea Demon, Horned Honor, Ragged Jenna, Trident Three, Swift Sword, Princess Rhaenys, Dog's Nose, Scepter, Faithful, Red Raven, Queen Alisanne, Cat, Courageous, and Dragonsbane. From every astern streamed the fiery heart of the Lord of Light, red and yellow and orange. Behind Davos and his sons came another line of hundreds, commanded by knights and lordly captains, and then the smaller, slower, Moorish contingent, none dipping more than 80 oars. Farther back would come the sailed ships, carracks, and lumbering great cogs, and last of all, Salador San in his proud Valyrian, a towering 300, paced by the rest of his galleys with their distinctive striped hulls. The flamboyant Lysene princeling had not been pleased to be assigned the rear guard, but it was clear that Sir Imri trusted him no more than Stannis did. "Too many complaints, and too much talk of the gold he was owed." Davos was sorry nonetheless. Salador San was a resourceful old pirate, and his crews were born seamen, fearless in a fight. They were wasted in the rear. "Ahoo!" The call rolled across white caps and churning oars from the forecastle of the Fury. Sir Imri was sounding the attack. "Ahoo! Ahoo!" Swordfish had joined the line at last, though she still had her sail raised. "Fast, crews!" Davos barked. The drum began to beat more quickly, and the stroke picked up, the blades of the oars cutting water. Splash whoosh, splash whoosh, splash whoosh. On deck, soldiers banged sword against shield, while archers quietly strung their bows and pulled the first arrow from the quivers at their belts. The galleys of the first line of battle obscured his vision, so Davos paced the deck, searching for a better view. He saw no sign of any boom. The mouth of the river was open, as if to swallow them all. Except, in his smuggling days, Davos had often jested that he knew the waterfront at King's Landing a deal better than the back of his hand, since he had not spent a good part of his life sneaking in and out of the back of his hand. The squat towers of raw new stone that stood opposite one another at the mouth of the Blackwater might mean nothing to Sir Imri Florent, but to him it was as if two extra fingers had sprouted from his knuckles. Shading his eyes against the westering sun, he peered at those towers more closely. They were too small to hold much of a garrison. The one on the north bank was built against the bluff, with the Red Keep frowning above. Its counterpart on the south shore had its footing in the water. "They dug a cut through the bank," he knew at once. That would make the tower very difficult to assault. Attackers would need to wade through the water or bridge the little channel. Stannis had posted bowmen below to fire up at the defenders whenever one was rash enough to lift his head above the ramparts, but otherwise had not troubled. Something flashed down low, where the dark water swirled around the base of the tower. It was sunlight on steel, and it told Davos Seaworth all he needed to know. "A chain boom, and yet they have not closed the river against us. Why?" He could make a guess at that as well, but there was no time to consider the question. A shout went up from the ships ahead, and the war horns blew again. The enemy was before them. Between the flashing oars of Scepter and Faithful, Davos saw a thin line of galleys drawn across the river, the sun glinting off the gold paint that marked their hulls. He knew those ships as well as he knew his own. When he had been a smuggler, he always felt safer knowing whether the sail on the horizon marked a fast ship or a slow one, and whether her captain was a young man hungry for glory or an old one serving out his days. "Ahoo!" the war horns called. "Battle speed!" Davos shouted. On port and starboard, he heard Dale and Allard giving the same command. Drums began to beat furiously, oars rose and fell, and Black Betha surged forward. When he glanced towards Wraith, Dale gave him a salute. Swordfish was lagging once more, wallowing in the wake of the smaller ships to either side. Elsewise, the line was straight as a shield wall. The river that had seemed so narrow from a distance now stretched wide as a sea, but the city had grown gigantic as well. Glaring down from Aegon's high hill, the Red Keep commanded the approaches. Its iron-crowned battlements, massive towers, and thick red walls gave it the aspect of a ferocious beast hunched above the river and streets. The bluffs on which it crouched were steep and rocky, spotted with lichen and gnarled thorny trees. The fleet would have to pass below the castle to reach the harbour and city beyond. The first line was in the river now, but the enemy galleys were backing water.
"They mean to draw us in. They want us jammed close, constricted. No way to sweep round their flanks. And with that boom behind us..."
He paced his deck, craning his neck for a better look at Joffrey's fleet. The boy's toys included the ponderous God's Grace he saw, the old slow Prince Aemon, the Lady of Silk and her sister, Lady Shame, Wildwind, Kingslander, Whiteheart, Lance, Seaflower. But where was the Lion Star? Where was the beautiful Lady Lyanna that King Robert had named in honour of the maid he loved and lost? And where was King Robert's Hammer? She was the largest war galley in the Royal Fleet, 400 oars, the only warship the boy king owned capable of overmatching fury. By rights, she should have formed the heart of any defence. Davos tasted a trap. Yet he saw no sign of any foes sweeping in behind them. Only the great fleet of Stannis Baratheon in their ordered ranks, stretching back to the watery horizon.
"Will they raise the chain and cut us in two?"
He could not see what good that would serve. The ships left out in the bay could still land men north of the city. A slower crossing, but safer. A flight of flickering orange birds took wing from the castle, 20 or 30 of them. Pots of burning pitch, arcing out over the river, trailing threads of flame. The waters ate most, but a few found the decks of galleys in the first line of battle, spreading flame where they shattered. Men-at-arms were scrambling on Queen Alysanne's deck, and he could see smoke rising from three different spots on Dragonsbane nearest the bank. By then a second flight was on its way, and arrows were falling as well, hissing down from the archers' nests that studded the towers above. A soldier tumbled over the cat's gunwale, crashed off the oars, and sank.
"The first man to die today," Davos thought, "but he will not be the last."
Atop the Red Keep's battlements streamed the boy king's banners, the crown stag of Baratheon on its gold field, the line of Lannister on crimson. More pots of pitch came flying. Davos heard men shriek as fire spread across Courageous. Her oarsmen were safe below, protected from missiles by the half-deck that sheltered them, but the men-at-arms, crowded topside, were not so fortunate. The starboard wing was taking all the damage, as he had feared.
"It'll be our turn soon,"
he reminded himself, uneasy. Black Betha was well in range of the firepots, being the sixth ship out from the north bank. To starboard, she had only Allard's Lady Maria, the ungainly Swordfish, so far behind now that she was nearer the third line than the second, and Piety, Prayer, and Devotion, who would need all the godly intervention they could get, placed as vulnerably as they were. As the second line swept past the twin towers, Davos took a closer look. He could see three links of a huge chain snaking out from a hole no bigger than a man's head and disappearing under the water. The towers had a single door, set a good 20 feet off the ground. Bowmen on the roof of the northern tower were firing down at Prayer and Devotion. The archers on devotion fired back, and Davis heard a man scream as the arrows found him.
"Captain, sir." His son Mathis was at his elbow. "Your helm."
Davis took it with both hands and slid it over his head. The butt helm was visorless. He hated having his vision impeded. By then the pitch putts were raining down around them. He saw one shatter on the deck of Lady Maria, but Allard's crew quickly beat it out. To port, war horns sounded from the Pride of Driftmark. The oars flung up sprays of water with every stroke. The yard-long shaft of a scorpion came down not 2 feet from Mathis and sank into the wood of the deck, thrumming. Ahead, the first line was within bowshot of the enemy. Flights of arrows flew between ships, hissing like striking snakes. South of the Blackwater, Davis saw men dragging crude rafts toward the water, while ranks and columns formed up beneath a thousand streaming banners. Their fiery heart was everywhere, though the tiny black stag imprisoned in the flames was too small to make out.
"We should be flying the crown stag," he thought. "The stag was King Robert's sigil. The city would rejoice to see it. This stranger's standard serves only to set men against us."
He could not behold the fiery heart without thinking of the shadow Melisandre had burst in the gloom beneath Storm's End.
"At least we fight this battle in the light, with the weapons of honest men," he told himself.
The Red Woman and her dark children would have no part of it. Stannis had shipped her back to Dragonstone with his bastard nephew, Edric Storm. His captains and bannermen had insisted that a battlefield was no place for a woman. Only the Queen's men had dissented, and then not loudly. All the same, the King had been on the point of refusing them until Lord Bryce Caron said, "Your Grace, if the sorceress is with us, afterward men will say it was her victory, not yours. They will say you owe your crown to her spells." That turned the tide. Davis himself had held his tongue during the arguments, but if truth be told, he had not been sad to see the back of her. He wanted no part of Melisandre or her guard. To starboard, devotion drove toward shore, sliding out a plank. Archers scrambled into the shallows, holding their bows high above their heads to keep the strings dry. They splashed ashore on the narrow strand beneath the bluffs. Rocks came bouncing down from the castle to crash among them, and arrows and spears as well. But the angle was steep, and the missiles seemed to do little damage. Prayer landed 24 yards upstream, and Piety was slanting towards the bank when the defenders came pounding down the riverside, the hooves of their war horses sending up gouts of water from the shallows. The knights fell among the archers like wolves among chickens, driving them back toward the ships and into the river before most could notch an arrow. Men-at-arms rushed to defend them with spear and axe, and in 3 heartbeats the scene had turned to blood-soaked chaos. Davis recognized the dog's head helm of the Hound. A white cloak streamed from his shoulders as he rode his horse up the plank onto the deck of Prayer, hacking down anyone who blundered within reach. Beyond the castle, King's Landing rose on its hills behind the encircling walls. The river front was a blackened desolation. The Lannisters had burned everything and pulled back within the mud gate. The charred spars of sunken hulks sat in the shallows, forbidding access to the long stone quays.
"We shall have no landing there."
He could see the tops of 3 huge trebuchets behind the mud gate. High on Visenya's hill, sunlight blazed off the 7 crystal towers of the great Sept of Baelor. Davos never saw a battle joined, but he heard it. A great rending crash as 2 galleys came together. He could not say which 2. Another impact echoed over the water an instant later, and then a 3rd. Beneath the screech of splintering wood, he heard the deep thrum-thump of the Fury's 4 catapult. Stag of the Sea split one of Joffrey's galleys clean in half, but Dog's Nose was afire, and Queen Alysanne was locked between Lady of Silk and Lady's Shame. a crew fighting the borders rail to rail. Directly ahead, Davis saw the enemy's Kingslander drive between Faithful and Scepter. The former slid her starboard oars out of the way before impact, but Scepter's portside oars snapped like so much kindling as Kingslander raked along her side. "Loose!" Davis commanded, and his bowmen sent a withering rain of shafts across the water. He saw Kingslander's captain fall and tried to recall the man's name. Ashore, the arms of the great trebuchets rose 1, 2, 3, and 100 stones climbed high into the yellow sky. Each one was as large as a man's head. When they fell, they sent up great gouts of water, smashed through oak planking, and turned living men into bone and pulp and gristle. All across the river, the first line was engaged. Grappling hooks were flung out. Iron rams crashed through wooden hulls. Boarders swarmed. Flights of arrows whispered through each other in the drifting smoke, and men died. But so far, none of his. Black Betha swept upriver, the sound of her oarmaster's drum thundering in her captain's head as he looked for a likely victim for her ram. The beleaguered Queen Alisande was trapped between two Lannister warships, the three made fast by hooks and lines. "Ram in speed!" Davis shouted. The drum beats blurred into a long, fevered hammering, and Black Betha flew, the water turning white as milk as it parted for her prow. Allard had seen the same chance. Lady Maria ran beside them. The first line had been transformed into a confusion of separate struggles. The three Tangle ships loomed ahead, turning, their decks a red chaos as men hacked at each other with sword and axe. "A little more," Davis Seaworth beseeched the warrior. "Bring around a little more. Show me your broadside." The warrior must have been listening. Black Betha and Lady Maria slammed into the side of Lady Shame within an instant of each other, ramming her fore and aft with such force that men were thrown off the deck of Lady of Silk 3 boats away. Davis almost bit his tongue off when his teeth jarred together. He spat out blood.
"Next time, close your mouth, you fool."
40 years at sea, and yet this was the first time he'd rammed another ship. His archers were loosing arrows at will.
"Backwater," he commanded.
When Black Betha reversed her oars, the river rushed into the splintered hole she left, and Lady Shame fell to pieces before his eyes, spilling dozens of men into the river. Some of the living swam, some of the dead floated, the ones in heavy mail and plate sank to the bottom, the quick and the dead alike. The pleas of drowning men echoed in his ears. A flash of green caught his eye, ahead and off to port, and a nest of writhing emerald serpents rose burning and hissing from the stern of Queen Alisande. An instant later, Davis heard the dread cry of "Wildfire!" He grimaced. Burning pitch was one thing, wildfire quite another. Evil stuff, and well-nigh unquenchable. Smother it under a cloak, and the cloak took fire. Slap at a fleck of it with your palm, and your hand was aflame. "Piss on wildfire, and your cock burns off," old seamen like to say. Still, Sir Emery had warned them to expect a taste of the alchemist's vile substance. Fortunately, there were few true pyromancers left. "They will soon run out," Sir Emery had assured them. Davis reeled off commands. One bank of oars pushed off, while the other backed water, and the galley came about. Lady Maria had one clear, too, and a good thing. The fire was spreading over Queen Alisande and her foes faster than he would have believed possible. Men wreathed in green flame leapt into the water, shrieking like nothing human. On the walls of King's Landing, spitfires were belching death, and the great trebuchets behind the mud gate were throwing boulders. One the size of an ox crashed down between Black Betha and Wraith, rocking both ships and soaking every man on deck. Another, not much smaller, found bold laughter. The Valerian galley exploded like a child's toy dropped from a tower, spraying splinters as long as a man's arm. Through black smoke and swirling green fire, Davos glimpsed a swarm of small boats bearing downriver, a confusion of ferries and wherries, barges, skiffs, rowboats and hulks that looked too rotten to float. It stank of desperation. Such driftwood could not turn the tide of a fight, only get in the way. The lines of battle were hopelessly ensnarled, he saw. Off to port, Lord Stefan, Ragged Jenner, and Swift Sword had broken through and were sweeping upriver. The starboard wing was heavily engaged, however, and the centre had shattered under the stones of those trebuchets, some captains turning downstream, others veering to board, anything to escape that crushing rain. Fury had swung her aft catapult to fire back at the city, but she lacked the range. The barrels of pitch were shattering under the walls. Sceptre had lost most of her oars, and Faithful had been rammed and was starting to list. He took Black Betha between them, and struck a glancing blow at Queen Circe's ornate carved and gilded pleasure barge, laden with soldiers instead of sweetmeats now. The collision spilled a dozen of them into the river, where Betha's archers picked them off as they tried to stay afloat. Mathis' shout alerted him to the danger from port. One of the Lannister galleys was coming about to ram.
"Hard to starboard!"
Davos shouted. His men used their oars to push free of the barge, while others turned the galley so her prow faced the onrushing White Hart. For a moment he feared he'd been too slow, that he was about to be sunk. But the current helped to swing Black Betha, and when the impact came it was only a glancing blow, the two hulls scraping against each other, both ships snapping oars. A jagged piece of wood flew past his head, sharp as any spear. Davos flinched.
"Board her!"
he shouted. Grappling lines were flung. He drew his sword and led them over the rail himself. The crew of the White Hart met them at the rail, but Black Betha's men-at-arms swept over them in a screaming steel tide. Davos fought through the press, looking for the other captain, but the man was dead before he reached him. As he stood over the body, someone caught him from behind with an axe, but his helm turned the blow, and his skull was left ringing where it might have been split. Dazed, it was all he could do to roll. His attacker charged, screaming. Davos grasped his sword in both hands and drove it up, point first, into the man's belly. One of his crewmen pulled him back to his feet. "Captain, sir, the Hart is ours." It was true, Davos saw. Most of the enemy were dead, dying, or yielded. He took off his helm, wiped blood from his face, and made his way back to his own ship, trotting carefully on boards slimy with men's guts. Mathis lent him a hand to help him back over the rail. For those few instants, Black Betha and White Hart were the calm eye in the midst of the storm. Queen Adasan and Lady of Silk, still locked together, were a raging green inferno, drifting downriver and dragging pieces of Lady Shame. One of the Moorish galleys had slammed into them and was now afar as well. Cat was taking on men from the fast-sinking Courageous. The captain of Dragonsbane had driven her between two quays, ripping out her bottom. Her crew poured ashore with the archers and men-at-arms to join the assault on the walls. Red Raven, rammed, was slowly listing. Stag of the Sea was fighting fires and boarders both, but the Fiery Heart had been raised over Joffrey's loyal man. Fury, her proud bow smashed in by a boulder, was engaged with God's Grace. He saw Lord Valerian's Pride of Driftmark crash between two Lannister river runners, overturning one and lighting the other up with fire arrows. On the south bank, knights were leading their mounts aboard the cogs, and some of the smaller galleys were already making their way across, laden with men-at-arms. They had to thread cautiously between sinking ships and patches of drifting wildfire. The whole of King Stannis's fleet was in the river now, save for Salador Sarn's Lyseni. Soon enough they would control the Blackwater.
Sir Imran will have his victory, Davos thought, and Stannis will bring his host across. But gods be good, the cost of this.
Captain, sir, Mathis touched his shoulder. It was Swordfish, her two banks of oars lifting and falling. She had never brought down her sails, and some burning pitch had caught in her rigging. The flame spread as Davos watched, creeping out over ropes and sails, until she trailed ahead of yellow flame, her ungainly iron ram, fashioned after the likeness of the fish from which she took her name, part of the surface of the river before her. Directly ahead, drifting toward her and swinging around to present a tempting plump target, was one of the Lannister hulks, floating low in the water. Slow green blood was leaking out between her boards. When he saw that, Davos Seaworth's heart stopped beating.
No, he said. No, no!
Above the roar and crash of battle, no one heard him but Mathis. Certainly the captain of the Swordfish did not, intent as he was on finally spearing something with his ungainly fat sword. The Swordfish went to battle speed. Davos lifted his maimed hand to clutch at the leather pouch that held his finger bones. With a grinding, splintering, tearing crash, Swordfish split the rutted hulk asunder. She burst like an overripe fruit, but no fruit ever screamed that shattering wooden scream. From inside her, Davos saw green gushing from 1,000 broken jars, poison from the entrails of a dying beast, glistening, shining, spreading across the surface of the river.
Backwater! He roared. Away! Get us off her! Backwater! Backwater!
The grappling lines were cut, and Davos felt the deck move under his feet as Black Betha pushed free of White Hart. Her oars slid down into the water. Then he heard a short, sharp, woof, as if someone had blown in his ear. Half a heartbeat later came the roar. The deck vanished beneath him, and black water smashed him across the face, filling his nose and mouth. He was choking, drowning. Unsure which way was up, Davos wrestled the river in blind panic until suddenly he broke the surface. He spat out water, sucked in air, grabbed hold of the nearest chunk of debris, and held on. Swordfish and the hulk were gone. Blackened bodies were floating downstream beside him, and choking men clinging to bits of smoking wood. 50 feet high, a swirling demon of green flame danced upon the river. It had 12 hands, in each a whip, and whatever they touched burst into fire. He saw Black Betha burning, and Whiteheart, and Loyal Man to either side. Piety, Cat, Courageous, Scepter, Red Raven, Harridan, Faithful, Fury, they had all gone up. Kingslander and God's Grace as well. The demon was eating his own. Lord Valerian's shining Pride of Driftmark was trying to turn, but the demon ran a lazy green finger across her silvery oars, and they flared up like so many tapers. For an instant, she seemed to be stroking the river with two banks of long, bright torches. The current had him in its teeth by then, spinning him around and around. He kicked to avoid a floating patch of wildfire.
My sons, Davos thought,
but there was no way to look for them amidst the roaring chaos. Another hulk, heavy with wildfire, went up behind him. The black water itself seemed to boil in its bed, and burning spars and burning men and pieces of broken ships filled the air.
I'm being swept out into the bay.
Wouldn't be as bad there. He ought to be able to make shore. He was a strong swimmer. Salador San's galleys would be out in the bay as well. Sir Imri had commanded them to stand off. And then the current turned him about again, and Davos saw what awaited him downstream.
The chain. God save us. They've raised the chain.
Where the river broadened out into Blackwater Bay, the boom stretched taut, a bare 2 or 3 feet above the water. Already a dozen galleys had crashed into it, and the current was pushing others against them. Almost all were aflame, and the rest soon would be. Davos could make out the striped hulls of Salador San's ships beyond, but he knew he would never reach them. A wall of red-hot steel, blazing wood, and swirling green flame stretched before him. The mouth of the Blackwater Rush had turned into the mouth of hell.
Eddard. The straw on the floor stank of urine. There was no window, no bed, not even a slop bucket. He remembered walls of pale red stone, festooned with patches of nitre, a grey door of splintered wood, 4 inches thick and studded with iron. He had seen them, briefly, a quick glimpse as they shoved him inside. Once the door had slammed shut, he had seen no more. The dark was absolute. He had as well been blind. Or dead, buried with his king.
"Ah, Robert,"
he murmured, as his groping hand touched a cold stone wall, his leg throbbing with every motion. He remembered the jest the king had shared in the crypts of Winterfell, as the kings of Winter looked on with cold stone eyes.
"The king eats," Robert had said, "and the hand takes the shit."
How he had laughed. Yet he had gotten it wrong. The king dies, Ned Stark thought, and the hand is buried. The dungeon was under the Red Keep, deeper than he dared imagine. He remembered the old stories about Maegor the Cruel, who murdered all the masons who labored on his castle so they might never reveal its secrets. He damned them all. Littlefinger, Janus Slint, in his gold cloaks, the Queen, the Kingslayer, Pycelle, and Varys, and Sir Barristan, even Lord Renly, Robert's own blood, who had run when he was needed most. Yet in the end, he blamed himself.
"Fool!" he cried to the darkness. "Thrice damn blind fool!"
Cersei Lannister's face seemed to float before him in the darkness. Her hair was full of sunlight, but there was mockery in her smile.
"When you play the Game of Thrones, you win or you die," she whispered.
Ned had played and lost, and his men had paid the price of his folly with their life's blood. When he thought of his daughters, he would have wept gladly, but the tears would not come. Even now he was a Stark of Winterfell, and his grief and his rage froze hard inside him. When he kept very still, his leg did not hurt so much, so he did his best to lie unmoving. For how long he could not say. There was no sun and no moon. He could not see to mark the walls. Ned closed his eyes and opened them. It made no difference. He slept and woke and slept again. He did not know which was more painful, the waking or the sleeping. When he slept, he dreamed. Dark, disturbing dreams of blood and broken promises. When he woke, there was nothing to do but think, and his waking thoughts were worse than nightmares. The thought of Cat was as painful as a bed of nettles. He wondered where she was, what she was doing. He wondered whether he would ever see her again. Hours turned to days, or so it seemed. He could feel a dull ache in his shattered leg, an itch beneath the plaster. When he touched his thigh, the flesh was hot to the fingers. The only sound was his breathing. After a time, He began to talk aloud, just to hear a voice. He made plans to keep himself sane, build castles of hope in the dark. Robert's brothers were out in the world raising armies at Dragonstone and Storm's End. Alan and Harwin would return to King's Landing with the rest of his household guard once they had dealt with Sir Gregor. Catelyn would raise the north when the word reached her, and the lords of River and Mountain and Vale would join her. He found himself thinking of Robert more and more. He saw the king as he had been in the flower of his youth, tall and handsome, his great antlered helm on his head, his war hammer in hand, sitting his horse like a horned god. He heard his laughter in the dark, saw his eyes blue and clear as mountain lakes. "Look at us, Ned," Robert said. "Gods, how do we come to this? You here, and me, killed by a pig. We won a throne together." "I failed you, Robert," Ned thought. He could not say the words. "I lied to you, hid the truth. I let them kill you." The king heard him. "Yes, stiff-necked fool," he muttered. "Too proud to listen. Can ye eat pride, Stark? Will honour shield your children?" Cracks ran down his face, fissures opening in the flesh, and he reached up and ripped the mask away. It was not Robert at all. It was Littlefinger, grinning, mocking him. When he opened his mouth to speak, his lies turned to pale grey moths and took wing. Ned was half asleep when the footsteps came down the hall. At first he thought he'd dreamt them. It had been so long since he had heard anything but the sound of his own voice. Ned was feverish by then, his leg a dull agony, his lips parched and cracked. When the heavy wooden door creaked open, the sudden light was painful to his eyes. A jailer thrust a jug at him. The clay was cool and beaded with moisture. Ned grasped it with both hands and gulped it eagerly. Water ran from his mouth and dripped down through his beard. He drank until he thought he would be sick. "How long?" he asked weakly when he could drink no more. The jailer was a scarecrow of a man with a rat's face and frayed beard, clad in a mail shirt and a leather half-cape. "No talking," he said, as he wrenched the jug from Ned's hands. "Please," Ned said, "my daughters." The door crashed shut. He blinked as the light vanished, lowered his head to his chest, and curled up on the straw. It no longer stank of urine and shit. It no longer smelled at all. He could no longer tell the difference between waking and sleeping. The memory came creeping upon him in the darkness, as vivid as a dream. It was the year of full spring, and he was 18 again, down from the Eyrie to the tawny at Harrenhal. He could see the deep green of the grass and smell the pollen on the wind. Warm days and cool nights and the sweet taste of wine. He remembered Brandon's laughter and Robert's berserk valour in the melee, the way he laughed as the unhorsed men left and right. He remembered Jaime Lannister, a golden youth in scaled white armour, kneeling on the grass in front of the king's pavilion and making his vows to protect and defend King Aerys. Afterward, Sir Oswald went, helped Jaime to his feet, and the White Ball himself, Lord Commander Sir Gerald Hightower, fastened the snowy cloak of the king's guard about his shoulders. All six white swords were there to welcome their newest brother. Yet when the jousting began, the day belonged to Rhaegar Targaryen. The crown prince wore the armour he would die in, gleaming black plate with a three-headed dragon of the house wrought in rubies on the breast. A plume of scarlet silk streamed behind him when he rode, and it seemed no lance could touch him. Brandon fell to him, and Bronze Yon Royce, and even the splendid Sir Arthur Dane, the Sword of the Morning. Robert had been jesting with John and old Lord Hunter as the prince circled the field after unhorsing Sir Barristan in the final tilt to claim the champion's crown. Ned remembered the moment when all the smiles died, when Prince Rhaegar Targaryen urged his horse past his own wife, the Dornish princess Ilya Martell, to lay the Queen of Beauty's laurel in Lyanna's lap. He could see it still, a crown of winter roses, blue as frost. Ned Stark reached out his hand to grasp the flowery crown, but beneath the pale blue petals, the thorns lay hidden. He felt them clawing at his skin, sharp and cruel, saw the slow trickle of blood run down his fingers, and woke, trembling, in the dark. "Promise me, Ned," his sister had whispered from her bed of blood. She had loved the scent of winter roses. "God save me," Ned wept. "I'm going mad." The guards did not deign to answer. Each time the turnkey brought him water, he told himself another day had passed. At first he would beg the man for some word of his daughter's and the world beyond his cell. Grunts and kicks were his only replies. Later, when the stomach cramps began, he begged for food instead. It made no matter. He was not fed. Perhaps the Lannisters meant for him to starve to death. No, he told himself, if Cersei wanted him dead, he would have been cut down in the throne room with his men. She wanted him alive, weak, desperate, yet alive. Catelyn held her brother. She dare not kill him, or the imp's life would be forfeit as well. From outside his cell came the rattle of iron chains. As the door creaked open, Ned put a hand to the damp wall and pushed himself toward the light. The glare of a torch made him squint. "Food," he croaked. "Wine," a voice answered. It was not the rat-faced man. This jailer was stouter, shorter, though he wore the same leather half-cape and spike-stilled cap. "Drink, Lord Eddard." He thrust a wineskin into Ned's hands. The voice was strangely familiar, yet it took Ned Stark a moment to place it. "Varys," he said groggily when it came. He touched the man's face. I'm not dreaming this. You're here." The eunuch's plump cheeks were covered with a dark stubble of beard. Ned felt the coarse hair with his fingers. Varys had transformed himself into a grizzled turnkey, reeking of sweat and sour wine. "How did you... What sort of magician are you?" "A thirsty one," Varys said. "Drink, my lord." Ned's hands fumbled at the skin. "Is this the same poison they gave Robert?" "Oh, you wrung me," Varys said sadly. "Truly, no one loves a eunuch. Give me the skin." He drank, a trickle of red leaking from the corner of his plump mouth. "Not the equal of the vintage you offered me the night of the tourney, but no more poisonous than most," he concluded, wiping his lips. "Here." Ned tried to swallow. Dregs. He felt as though he were about to bring the wine back up. "All men must swallow the sour with the sweet. High lords and eunuchs alike. Your hour has come, my lord." "My daughters." "The younger girl escaped Samirin and fled," Varys told him. "I have not been able to find her, nor have the Lannisters. A kindness there. Our new king loves her not. Your older girl is still betrothed to Joffrey. Cersei keeps her close. She came to court a few days ago to plead that you be spared. A pity you couldn't have been there. You would have been touched." He leaned forward intently. "I trust you realize that you are a dead man, Lord Eddard." "The Queen will not kill me," Ned said. His head swam. The wine was strong, and it had been too long since he'd eaten. Cat holds her brother the wrong brother, Varys sighed, and lost to her in any case. She let the imp slip through her fingers.